This is a Republic if you can keep it. An inside look at Michigan and national politics with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
I'm Jeff Timmer. Welcome to the stormy weather edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It. As we record the podcast, we await what appears to be the inevitable indictment of Donald Trump by the state of New York for charges growing out of his one-night stand and $130,000 in hush money paid to Stormy Daniels. It could well be the first of multiple indictments as investigations close in on the Trump crime family in Georgia and Washington, D.C.
And I am Mark Brewer. Artificial intelligence, better known as AI, is all the rage. It is more than a tool for school kids to get help with papers or pass the bar exam without breaking a sweat. It can be a dangerous new tool for manipulating elections by unscrupulous campaigns, hostile foreign governments, or Tucker Carlson. No longer will hearing or seeing be believing, while what sounds or looks real could all be a deception created on a computer. Helping us wade through this new technology and the threats it portends will be Dennis Kennedy, director of the Center for Law, Technology, and Innovation at MSU's School of Law.
We begin with a confession. Everything you've heard so far in this podcast is computer generated. Our producer put this together in his home office 2 days ago. Mark and I have spent the last few days catching up on our NCAA brackets and letting the computers do the work.
I'm not even here. The reality is that I am off this week, and our producer, Walt Sorg, will be sitting in for me. So, bye-bye.
And I'm really here. No more artificial. And when it comes to intelligence, I guess we can let our listeners decide about that, Jeff. So, Jeff, let's start with a quick rundown of the week's political developments. We've got a couple of updates from the world of 2024 Michigan candidates. First, it looks like Alyssa Slotkin could have a couple of long-shot opponents in the Democratic primary that she totally ignores. But more importantly, she's kind of settled on a new issue as a part of her primary campaign strategy.
Yeah, I think it's it's clear and I think very intuitive. This isn't something that's necessarily a poll tested issue, though the polls, as we talked about last week, show that gun safety is a huge winner for candidates like Alyssa Slotkin. But her now in Congress representing first Oxford High School and Michigan State University, where these two mass shootings have taken place in the last 15-16 months. This is something that clearly matters to her. She has seized this as kind of the organizing theme of her campaign, about the time for dithering, the time for contemplating, the time for thoughts and prayers are over. She has had enough and she's ready to take action, and she's taking a decidedly Old Testament approach to this. The time to act is now, and if you're not willing to be on the team, get out of the way.
This kind of echoes her campaign when she first ran for Congress, taking an issue that's very personal to her and using that as a major theme of her campaign. When she ran the first time, she ran on healthcare, and it was personal to her because her mother died of cancer after losing her healthcare for financial reasons. And that helped her create a bond with voters who saw that, no, this is no phony politician. This is somebody who really cares about an important issue.
So many politicians try to manufacture a brand, try to manufacture an image, try to manufacture an issue to ride. And you can't make something like this up. Voters, there's just too many people looking at you too often. They see through the fake. They recognize sincerity. And this is something that you can just tell matters to her. Watching her response, the press hits that she was doing from East Lansing in the days after the shooting, going back then, having seen those, I went back and looked at the things she was saying after Oxford. This is not somebody who's got their moisten their finger and put it to the wind. This is somebody who cares. And it's one of these, I guess, what makes it such a a good politician is when they're willing to tackle these issues and they don't care about the political ramifications. You know, I'm going to campaign on this. And if it's not right, you know, I don't give a shit. I think it's the right thing to do. And I'm going forward. That kind of throw caution to the wind because you're passionate about it is what can really drive home a campaign. And I think she starts off as certainly the favorite in the Democratic primary, especially as more and more signs are out there that Jocelyn Benson is going to forego the race. If she doesn't, I'll reevaluate that. But right now, I mean, given Alyssa Slotkin and two other candidates who, when you mentioned them to me, I said, who the hell are they? You know, Alyssa Slotkin doesn't need to worry about losing this primary. She's going to get 80%+ of the vote in the primary, and she's going to be the prohibitive favorite against whoever the Republican is in November of 24.
She also has the advantage of being immune to the idea that she hates guns. She is military certified for both a Glock 9mm and for the M4 assault rifle, and has literally carried them overseas. So nobody's going to say that she hates guns.
Well, they'll try, but oh, yeah. I think she'll be able to swat it down pretty easily.
We've got a new development in her congressional district right now. One of the possible favorites to succeed her in the Democratic primary is out, the mayor of Lansing, Andy Shore, who I must say, first of all, is a longtime personal friend of mine. And I'm quite surprised that he pulled out. I don't know whether it was because the polling said he couldn't do it or his stated reason that he couldn't be an effective mayor of Lansing and a candidate at the same time.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know Andy well enough to, you know, be inside his personal decision. I have good friends who are close to him, who, you know, say that he's sincere. He really takes the job of mayor seriously, wants to do a good job, would take that same attitude toward a run for Congress. And it really, a campaign at this level in a district that's this high profile, one of the, you know, in 2022 was the most expensive congressional district in the country, the highest profile congressional district in the country. It certainly takes an all-in kind of candidate. And it says a lot of him that he was able to evaluate and say, I can't do both well. And I think he's sincere in that. But I think it also gets into, you know, the real political pressures that are at work here. The same thing I've been talking about since Debbie Stabenow announced her retirement, how there is going to be a tremendous pressure for the field to be cleared for Alyssa Slotkin. I think there's going to be tremendous pressures exerted to clear the Democratic field. We've talked about the Michigan Democrats, the Ingham County Democrats in particular, have a wealth of bench talent. You know, people like Curtis Hertel and Andy Shore and Barb Byram and Julie Brixey and Angela Whitwer and other names that have been mentioned here. And the thing that they can least afford, the national Democrats can least afford, is to wait until August of 2024, while a number of those candidates beat each other's brains out, spend all the money doing so, while Tom Barrett sits back on the Republican side, not raising money because he doesn't do that. He sucks. But waiting for the Democrat nominee to come out broken, wounded, that's a recipe for disaster. So there's tremendous pressures to clear the field. It looks to me, and I have no inside knowledge of this, but it looks to me just by the reading of the tea leaves here, Andy Shore gets out. I'm hearing that Curtis Hertel is less inclined to run. Now, that might not be the case. He could get in, but that means that it looks like Barb Byram would be the beneficiary of this Ingham County clerk. She'd have to forego her run for reelection. You know, she's got skin in the game. This isn't a free run for her. She's up for reelection in 2024 as Ingham County clerk. So it's a gamble for her to run on the Democratic side. Even if she wins the primary, it's a gamble whether or not she wins the race, but she's clearly, making all the moves, and might be the one that, the Washington, Democratic Party forces have settled on.
It would be really ironic if she were to be the nominee, given that 23 years ago, her mother ran for the congressional seat that is centered in Lansing, lost by 160 votes to Mike Rogers, and it was never close again because they redrew the district to make sure Mike Rogers would never have another tough race. 23 years, but it would be an interesting turnaround for the Byram family.
Yeah, that it definitely would. And just before we bring our guest in, I wanted to just mention Mike Rogers has been in the news in the last 24 hours. A Fox News story about Mike Rogers interview where he is openly talking now about his interest in running for president of the United States. And I would I'll say I count Mike as a friend, from my old days in the Republican Party. He was one of the normal ones, not one of these freaks and kooks and MAGAs. But him thinking that there's a path for a candidate with his kind of resume and with his attitudes toward today's MAGAs shows how out of touch he is with today's Republican voters. I mean, it's just completely ludicrous that Republican voters of 2024 are going to go for a normal Republican like Mike Rogers.
Jeff and Walt talk about the impact of artificial intelligence on campaigns with legal expert Dennis Kennedy after these messages on A Republic, if you can keep it.
Epic MRA is pleased to sponsor this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and public policy issues.
Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, all levels of state and local government, and membership organizations. For the November 2022 election, Epic MRA published the most accurate final pre-election poll among several state and national polling firms.
Our polls most closely predicted the actual election results in races for governor, secretary of state, and attorney general, as well as the three ballot proposals.
Epic MRA is clearly the go-to polling firm in Michigan. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Ben Franklin may have invented the Franklin stove to stay warm, but we go Ben one better. We have the Ben Franklin hoodie, dedicated to Americans for sanity. But wait, there's more. Our merch store has coffee mugs for Democrats, uncrazy Republicans, and free-thinking independents, as well as t-shirts for the discerning democracy lover. Just click on the merch center link on our homepage, arepublicpodcast.com. Show your support for political sanity at the podcast merch store. It's your duty as an American.
This is your favorite president. You should know that no president in the history of our country has committed more crimes than me, but I always get away with it. You should also know that deep down, I think that Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer are two of the very best political analysts in the history of political analysis. They should have their own show on my favorite cable news channel, MSNBC.
Thank you for inviting me on to A Republic, if you can keep it. This is without doubt the greatest political podcast ever produced. As my dad used to say to me, Joey, if you find a great podcast, you have to make sure everyone knows about it. So that's why I am here today. But enough about me. Back to the stars of the podcast, Jeff Timmer and Walt Sorg.
Obviously, neither of the 2020 candidates, and 2024 candidates for that matter, is with us today. That audio is totally fake, created by an easy-to-access online app. And therein lies the challenge for future campaigns. As voice and video cloning apps become more powerful and more prevalent, what will we be able to believe? As Cyborg Mark noted in the open, what's to stop a sleazy political campaign or a foreign government or Tucker Carlson from creating totally fake and damaging content and then pumping it through social media or cable news shows?
Joining us to explore the technology frontiers is the director of Michigan State University's Center for Law, Technology and Innovation, Dennis Kennedy. He is currently president of Dennis Kennedy Advisory Services, where he focuses on legal technology, innovation, speaking, writing, and coaching. He also chairs the board of the American Bar Association's Legal Technology Resource Center. Dennis is a graduate of Georgetown Law School. And Dennis, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast to explore the Wild West of AI and what it means for politics and for society. Dennis, great to have you join us on the podcast. As you just heard, with software that I'm paying $5 a month for, I can create just about anything I want to create. And some of it's very realistic, scarily realistic, some of it not so much. But this is like the Wild West in the legal world. Where do you begin as you start to analyze this from a legal standpoint?
Well, there's a whole bunch of different issues that that AI is raising, and I sometimes call this new GPT experiment the world's largest public beta, and because it's just been released out there, and people are trying everything, and it's almost anything that you can think of. It raises a legal issue of some kind, and generally without any kind of resolution. So we've already seen in the AI world, can an AI have a patent? Can an AI have a copyright, which was originally no, and now it's sort of maybe on that. And then people start to analyze things in a traditional legal framework, and then they realize it doesn't apply very well. So in education, for example, when people looked at ChatGPT, they said, well, that's plagiarism, right? And I'm like, I'm not really sure it's plagiarism. You're not really copying anything. It sort of falls more in the category of paying somebody to write a paper for you. So lots of legal issues all over the place, but kind of hard to say what are the definitive answers. And almost day by day, it changes. 'Cause even your examples, they don't fit into traditional intellectual property or legal categories, the clips that you generated.
What about defamation, though? What if I put so many words into somebody's mouth that are clearly wrong, which is what I've done with those two examples? What rights do Donald Trump and Joe Biden have if I have them saying something that's just totally off the wall and perhaps destroys their political careers?
Well, I think that you would make the argument that you're in this world of defamation, and then you would sort of apply the framework. Are they public figures? Do they have certain protections? Is it a satire? Which I would say your initial reaction to what you generated is, yeah, that's a satire, that's a parody, that's so can it really be defamation? And then you have the question, is it, if I'm using prompts, for example, rather than typing the exact words, are you really defaming somebody, or is it in some weird way the AI that's defaming? And are they in this sort of what's known in the legal world as the Section 230 safe harbor? And where you might not have liability, because we see it's to the benefit of all of us that on the internet we can say things and we have this sort of freedom to say a bunch of things and there's almost a little bit of safe harbor from liability. And so it gets complicated very fast, because in your examples, like Joe Biden or Donald Trump might want to say, that is defamation, or you've infringed my copyright, which is another thing that politicians have done over the last, say, 10 years as a way to protect what they're saying or to keep other people from using it. And you're just saying, hey, it's a joke, like everybody, it's obvious this is a joke.
Right. Well, I wouldn't imagine this. I mean, if you impressionists, impersonations, are in parodies and Saturday Night Live, people have pretended to be political figures and public figures for a long time. My Cartoon President that I think Showtime did. It would seem that the context in which these AI generated messages are delivered would matter. Yeah, if they're put out there in a way, you know, it's the malice standard, right? I mean, if they're put out there in a way that, okay, this Joe Biden said this, and he, you know, and it's proven to be actually not something that he said, but you're putting it out there as fact. That's different than if we're using it in this kind of tongue in cheek context, like we started off our podcast with today.
Yeah. So they have that notion of what's the intent. Then also if people are making money off of it, frankly, you know, cause you think about it, you know, here in Michigan, remember, think back to the old commercials where, they hired a Bob Seger sound-alike, because Bob Seger wouldn't agree to appear in the commercials. And, you know, and there are issues, all kinds of legal issues around that. Because you say, like, what is it about me that I'm able to protect? And that's where we've kind of moved into this lots of gray areas. Because you used to have, like, traditional intellectual property rights. And you said, well, maybe there's a right to privacy. Maybe there's some right to publicity. Now we're kind of like, do I have a right to my image? Do I have a right to, you know, a video of me? What is it that I can protect? And as a society, what do we want to say is okay and you're not allowed to protect versus, you know, things that are problematic, which is where, you know, the deepfakes really come into this because they can be used for good. They can be used for evil. And they're getting to be so good and so easy to generate. And, you know, for $5 a month, like they're so cheap to generate. That people are saying, like, well, here are all the concerns. Plus, are we going to put, like, you know, voiceover people, actors, everybody else out of work because we could just generate sort of good, you know, better than good enough characterizations and video, audio, that sort of thing?
Yeah. Well, when it comes to very recognizable public figures like, you know, Joe Biden or Donald Trump, that's one thing. And we can track down what they've said and what they haven't said. Maybe the same would go for some very high profile figures, governors, candidates at that level. But as we were, you know, talking before the show started, my mind immediately goes to the nefarious things that can be done here, the dirty tricks. You know, I come from the world of campaign, political campaigns and partisan political campaigns. And I start to look at how can bad actors use things like this? Probably not in broadcast ads that are on TV or radio, but things that are delivered to your phone, to your voicemail. You could take lesser known candidates and completely make up things that they haven't said and deliver it to a segment of people and do so largely undetected. That's where it gets scary.
Yeah, because it's hard to know where it's coming from. And then you have all these different channels. So I could do something on TikTok, for example. You know, we used to laugh in the days back in the days, remember when we used to like answer our phone when it rang? And we also had like, voicemail machines, answering machines. And you would get home and you'd turn on the answering machine and go like, oh my God, Barbara Streisand called me to donate, you know, to go out and vote for somebody. And now you have no idea whether, you know, any of that's real. So you have that on the one hand. On the other hand, you say that on these sort of down ballot races, you're right. They can slice and dice and segment in so many ways that, you know, I wouldn't know of those people. Those candidates don't have recognizable voices, and you could do positive or negative, and I could be fooled either way.
Yeah, I've been involved in campaigns before where something will show up anonymously, a videotape. This is 25 years ago. A videotape shows up at my office, and it's the opponent in, you know, a hot mic kind of setting. And in 1996, this probably was real. That wasn't AI generated, right? And then not having a paper trail of who did this, where did it come from? You know, there's no way to kind of track this down. And then a campaign, even one not necessarily trying to deceive or manipulate has you know, a gut check moment. Do I use this or not? You know, you don't know the provenance of where it came from. Now with audio deepfakes and video deepfakes, I mean, we haven't even really got into that. We've been playing some audio here because, you know, we're an audio podcast. But it would be pretty easy to do this. Something shows up in your email, effectively on your doorstep. You're in a campaign, and it's purported to be your opponent, you know, saying X, Y, or Z. And you got to, you know, what obligation, what legal obligation, let alone ethical obligation, does somebody have to check out the provenance of this, rather than, you know, say, here, reporter, I got this, and it might be my opponent, and it becomes a story or not. There's a whole lot of legal gray area, it would seem to me.
Well, and even on the media side, you think, because I look at Twitter and I joke with some of my friends that people now do this thing. I call it the big if true tweet, right? So you got like, here's something, and this is big if it's true. But I'm not right. I'm not saying one way or the other.
Sounds like Tucker Carlson.
I'm blasting out there, it out.
Yeah. Yeah, just chumming the waters here. Yep, right.
and then you say, you start to think about like, well, look how easy this stuff is, because it's not like, oh, we found this video, like you said, a hot mic or something. Well, we could put you on to, you know, what looks like CCTV footage. We could do all these sorts of things, and it will be really hard for somebody to tell. And then we have, you know, I mean, I guess it sort of helps us that we're now so suspicious of the so-called October surprise. So these things that would happen like really close to election, we might be super suspicious no matter how realistic they look. But that's almost the only protection we have is like really hard to authenticate anything.
You mentioned Section 230, which pretty much gives a free ride to the social networks for things they distribute, that they're just a distribution channel and not legally liable. But it seems like they really are the ones that have to be the gatekeeper for these and watching out for them, because you can literally reach 100 million people in a day, especially, say, if you're working at one of the Russian or North Korean or Chinese factories that churn out all sorts of false social media content already.
Yeah, and I think that's the trade-off that we have, is that we say in the U.S., we don't want the government to, you know, to censor what can be said, and are we kind of outsourcing it to the big tech companies, big social media companies, and there's, you know, potentially good from that. There's potentially bad from that because when you disconnect somebody from social media or the internet, they lose their voice and has really, you know, really significant consequences. And so, you know, the fact that the social media companies took Trump off of, their platforms without taking, you know, like say the opposition candidates off, is problematic, you know, at least theoretically. And so you say, well, at least in government, maybe there's some accountability on that. Do we have the same accountability with the tech companies? What is that accountability? You know, is the accountability better or worse once we get Elon Musk in on Twitter? You know, and so these things become truly difficult to say, like, how would we legislate that? How do we make decisions about it? What's even, you know, like, what is even a good way? And I think that's where, like to say a lot that, that law always lags behind tech. And these days it just feels like law is lagging so far behind tech, and tech is changing, it seems almost daily. And we just keep being confronted by these truly difficult issues.
Are there any efforts that you're aware of in state legislatures or in Congress to try to tackle some of these AI voice and video issues? Or is this still so new that nobody has ventured down that path yet?
Well, so AI has sort of been around, as they say, it's a 70-year overnight success. You know, so it's been around since the 50s, and the same issues have been kind of around. It's just, I would say, like in the last 2-3 months, it's just the it's just kind of exploded. Like, and the adoption has been like nothing that we've ever seen. And so it does seem like something is changing daily. So like I teach a class in AI and law at Michigan State. And so last week we were talking about, you know, one set of subjects, and between that last class and our class on Monday, GPT-4 came out. And one of the things people showed was that it could pass not only could it pass the bar exam, it could score in the 90th percentile, and it just did incredibly well on SATs and like all these tests. And so the class became, you know, like, okay, so now you're a law student and you have to take the bar exam, and it's possible an AI could do better than you are. Like, does it still make sense, you know, to take the bar exam? So I think that in the, as you look at legislatures and they have all the issues that, you know, are going on, it's like really hard to imagine the U.S. Congress passing any substantive law in the next 2 years, frankly.
Right.
So would they want to take on AI in a sort of what we would say like a measured, thoughtful way? Is that even possible?
Measured, thoughtful governance? No, I think now that you say that, that sounds pretty ridiculous, doesn't it?
You got people who don't even know how to use a flip phone in the Senate.
Oh, right. Sure. I mean, yeah, I mean, you got people like Chuck Grassley who were there riding dinosaurs. So, I mean, you know, that's, yeah, these people in technology this is going to be a bridge too far for their minds to even comprehend the technology, let alone the implications, and let alone what kind of statutes or regulations should govern it, because they don't even understand it.
And we're trying to slot things into the legal and legislative categories that are, you know, that seem like they make sense to us that maybe no longer do. So in my class, I said, okay, if we agree that we need to regulate AI in some way, tell me, where do we put that regulation? Okay, tell me the agency. Is it going to be Congress? Is it going to be the executive branch? We're not seriously going to throw yet another thing to the courts where we say an issue comes up in 4 years from now, we have a Supreme Court decision. That's not an effective way to do it. And we say, does it go to FTC? Does it go to, you know, where does it sit? And even that, to say who has responsibility, is really tricky. The most interesting thing I heard along those lines, which sort of shows how desperate the situation is, was somebody suggesting that what we need was like some national blue ribbon commission to like look into this and make recommendations that would be adopted. And you go like, man, we're down the road to where a blue ribbon commission starts to make sense. Like, that's not a great place to be.
Yeah, well, I mean, what starts to make sense is Linda Hamilton and Arnold Schwarzenegger showing up. Well, just say, screw it. The cyborgs are taking over, and this is it. It's been a good run, humanity.
it's sort of like, though, in the Pentagon, they always say we're always fighting the last war. And
right.
The process is so slow on the government regulatory side, takes weeks, months. By the time they figure out what's going on today, we're light years down the road for it. I think back, though, even to the Nixon campaign and how this was used even back then. They had a guy named Donald Segretti whose job was, they called rat fucking, which was basically creating havoc for the other side. He forged a letter in the name, or a statement in the name of Ed Muskie, the so-called Canuck letter, which basically drove Muskie out of the race, because it drove Muskie to tears. And that was the end of his campaign. And they did it specifically to get him out of there. You turn this thing loose now with computer power and the ever increasing computer power, and you literally can control elections from a laptop in Moscow.
Yeah, I think there is a thing that used to say, like, well, back in those days, maybe we could tell that the film was edited, right? Because it had to be done physically. Maybe we could tell that something was forged. Now it's like, what if we're able to create essentially perfect fakes, and not just, you know, like, I go on Wikipedia sometimes and I see that some famous person, that there is a copy of their signature on their Wikipedia page, you know? And so imagine what you can do with that. And then you start to say, I do all these other things, and I can play with them, and I can make them even more realistic, and I can make, you know, the voice sound the same. And
we're already
seeing the like the cyber criminals, say what I can do is, and I believe this is a Microsoft tool, that with 3 seconds of voice, I can basically, you know, do a fake voice that you can't tell from the original and have it say whatever I want. And so what people are using is say, I just fake the voice of your boss. And, you know, your boss calls you and says, hey, I left my corporate credit card. Like, give me your credit card so I can charge something for you. And you go, sure, I'll do that. So most of us know better than that at this point. But that becomes super effective. Or people will say, this sounds like my child asking for money, or, you know, something like that. And you'll do something because it's indistinguishable from what you expect to hear. And I think that becomes difficult. And it's going to be hard to pull that stuff apart. To say, like, how do I know this is faked or not, especially in the time frames we're talking about, right? So the things that get released really close to election, we may not be able to pull them apart. And we think about this, because we saw this in the last election where you have people just like lying about their entire resumes. And you say, okay, so it took us till after the election. So what's the remedy for that? Like, how, like, what do we do? Do we say there's part of you that says, well, we should have another election, but then people are saying, well, we don't really want to do that. How do we know the results would be changed? Those sorts of things. And we get into this weird world of like, well, what's the cause? You know, what was the cause? What's the effect? What's the remedy? What does make sense?
This last week, as we were anticipating this show, has been the first time I've ever sat and thought about this, and learning that you teach in this area of the law. How mature is this field of law around the country where conversations like this have been had or are being had? Because, you know, that's going to take some hive thinking to start to anticipate not only, you know, where we're at today, but where we're going to be at tomorrow when they release GPT-5.
Yeah, I mean, it's an odd thing, because I went to law school, and it was in 1982. I went to Georgetown Law School, and we had one of the first computers in the law seminars. And we talked about AI probably in two of those classes. I would say like the same issues, you know, same legal issues come up. Just different examples. So instead of self-driving cars, we were talking about, imagine you had an AI that was doing air traffic control and a plane crashed. What was, you know, but now it seems like so much has changed. And I would say if you went out right now and you said, I have this AI issue and I need to find an AI lawyer, somebody who does it, I don't think you're going to have an easy time finding anybody, you know, at this point.
And it took me a while to find you.
Yeah. and I'm not even a practicing lawyer, right? So so you haven't technically found the lawyer who can help you, like if you had an actual legal issue. But yeah, I think it's you see these new things, and then they're happening in. So before I retired from being a technology lawyer at MasterCard, before I started got into teaching at both MSU, and I also teach a class at Michigan Law School. And you know, you start to see that you're thinking like, oh, this could be like an ease, you know, can we figure this out? Does it fit into the normal patterns? And it doesn't. And then we're in this, you realize we're in these, you know, complex systems. And so we think we're going to make this little change here. And it causes all these unintended things to happen. So you'd say like, oh, maybe we should just like pass a law. And then also there's like the pass a law thing. Like, let's just pass a law that says you can't use deep fakes in election campaigns. And you go, okay, well, what elected body is going to pass that, because it potentially is to their advantage not to stop it, right? And then you say, okay, so how do we make it stop? And then and as the technology changes, you say like, well, the law that we wrote doesn't even apply anymore. You know, it's like we had to make it so vague to cover things. Well, if we made it specific, it, you know, it doesn't address what's happening. And that's why I sort of, when I think about the courts, I say, okay, we have something with ChatGPT right now that goes to court. In 4 years from now, if we get a Supreme Court decision, like, is anybody still even using ChatGPT at that point? Like, does the case really have any value at that point?
It'd be like suing Microsoft Explorer at this point.
Right.
It's gone.
Yeah. Right. I mean, exactly. Because, the time lag is so great. And then we're also, so I think we're looking at these things where we say, and I tell my students this, I say, at the early days of the internet, we made a decision as a society that the potential for innovation and the value of the internet was such that we wanted to open the doors to experimentation. And we sort of made that decision consciously. In comparison, there are things like, editing human genes and biotech things where we say, we're not going to touch that, right? There might be potential there, but we're not going there. So we have this notion of guardrails that we could put there. And then it becomes a sort of thing, is AI more like that biotech side, or is it more like the internet side? And then we say, but the internet was great because it was like this equalizer so that everybody could, you know, have your own printing press, do all the things that could happen on the internet. Now it's kind of like we have these big tech companies that have this enormous amount of wealth from the internet, and they're moving into AI, which also gives them more wealth. And so it's not like you don't have the same equalizing effect. And so then you say, well, now, and this is why I say that you push one place and something else happens, you go like, well, so maybe we have to use the antitrust laws. Well, the antitrust laws were written back in the 1930s. Like, do they even apply to what's, you know, do they conceptually apply to what we're doing? And so I think the technology has made it super difficult, in the legal world. And, you know, what I try to teach the students is like, you're the ones who are, you know, have lived with this, you're going to deal with it. And it's like, you need to have frameworks to deal with these issues within a world that's actually becoming much more complex. Where there may be more profound and unexpected results of what, you know, the regulation that you tried to do. And that's before we get into the global world, right? Which makes it even more complex.
Well, Dennis, you have succeeded in scaring the living hell out of me.
Me too.
I'm an optimist. I'm an optimist, though. I don't know if that's what passes for optimism day. I think it's really difficult for us to, but I think at some point, that's why the Blue Ribbon Commission thing is kind of attractive. Like, well, maybe we just get like a bunch of smart people and like have them think it through and make recommendations, and we just say like, whatever they come up with, let's start that direction, because kind of having this free for all and letting the big tech companies decide what's best for us may not be the way that we really want to go, because that is what is happening as we sit here.
Oh my God, the future of democracy is Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg.
Well, no, right, we need exactly. We need an AI Blue Ribbon Commission that comes up with AI regulations and then is adjudicated by AI judges who've passed the bar AI.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting is when I run things in ChatGPT to see what it looks like, my reaction is, because I do a lot of writing and I consider myself a writer, is that what comes out, I feel like it's the work of a committee that was trying to come up with consensus, and it had some lawyers on the committee too. So it's like the worst of all possible results. You know, you're going like, well, right. this is super vague. There's no actionable in here. There's a lot of like nice sounding things, but in terms of actual action, I think it's hard. And then to say, because of the complexity, how do we get all the right people into the room? you know, to have those conversations.
Well, the AI is still in its infancy. If you really want to be scared, just remember that from the time that the Wright brothers flew for the first time for 100 yards, within 60 years, Neil Armstrong was walking on the moon. So yep. Things can progress and progress pretty rapidly. And that's the real threat. This AI is going to get a whole lot better.
And then hopefully we're just going to get this new generation to come in that will say, as you're talking about it, when we look at, you know, especially the U.S. Congress and Senate, we say like, you know, sometimes it's good to have the wise old ones around, but and other times we kind of need some fresh perspectives here on, you know, who've lived with this and have an understanding of it.
Well, Dennis, we have run out of time. We thank you so much for your insights and for scaring the hell out of us. But
this is no charge.
We're going to be talking about for a long, long time.
No charge for scaring you. No, it's been totally fun. I you know, you can tell I love thinking about, you know, what's coming in, you know, in these areas and how we need to think about it and grapple with it, which we really need to do.
And that's a wrap for this week. Our deep thanks to Dennis Kennedy for his insights into the legal complications and challenges posed by artificial intelligence. And Jeff, if I could add this, I think next week we're going to have Barack Obama as our guest, since now it's so easy for me to create him.
Well, our thanks to your MacBook, Walt, for letting the computer handle the introductions to this podcast. If the Republic is still standing, Mark and I will return in a week. Or will it be our cyborg doppelgangers?
A Republic If You Can Keep It with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.